welcome to a special episode of Irreverent Testimony, brought to you by Netroots Radio, a political podcast by and for millennial and Gen Xer types. This week is going to be a special episode because we will be airing the first episode of a new spinoff podcast called No Boys Allowed, which is going to be a podcast where we hear voices of non-cis men, essentially. So a bunch of ladies and people who identify across the gender spectrum. It's not because we don't love men, and it's not because we hate men. It's because we think that maybe there needs to be space for non-men to talk about politics. So today on the episode, you're going to hear some familiar voices from Netroots Radio and from our podcast. We have with us Arliss Bunny from Hopping Mad.
Hey.
We have with us Molly, who's been on Irreverent Testimony multiple times.
Hey, everyone.
And our old friend Sarah Burris from Raw Story.
Hello.
All right, ladies. So where do we want to start? Anybody have anything burning you want to talk about?
I do.
Go.
Okay. So I did this media training. This is like totally non-political.
Great.
I did this media training with the Women's Media Center. And you remember how empowering the Women's March was?
Yes.
Like how we all came out of that feeling like, oh my God, not only am I not alone, but there are some badass women who exist all over the place who are standing up and they're ready to fight. And I don't feel alone. And I feel like we're going to do this and we're going to like keep doing it until we achieve everything that we need and all of these amazing things that came out of it. So if you look at that and just boiled it down to 10 women in a conference room, that was my weekend.
Nice.
Wow.
It was so empowering. And I was sitting at this table with these women where I was just like, oh my God, you are all the most amazing people. You are so incredible and smart and skilled, and they are doing the best possible work in so many different ways. And it was just like, oh, this is the best weekend of my life.
That's amazing.
So, right? That is so great.
Oh, so badass.
That's awesome.
So props to the Women's Media Center and to all of the badass women who have done their trainings.
Hell yeah. So what was the substance of it? Like, what did you guys talk about? I mean, it was a whole weekend, so I'm sure tons, but.
Yeah. So the training is for basically taking their goal of the Women's Media Center is to put more women in the media. And so they try and find some of us who, I've been applying for it for years, and they take, I think, something like 30 women every year.
Wow.
Congrats. Yeah, and they get probably 500 applications, you know?
Yeah.
Wow.
So people like Sally Cohn, who's on CNN, went through their training and they helped her get on CNN. There are just so many women who do this kind of communications work who they want to amplify. And so it basically, they put you in front of a camera and teach you how to write message boxes and how to craft sound bites and teach you how to be on camera.
Wow. And,
yeah.
That's amazing. Well, congratulations.
That's
a big
incredible.
Deal.
Holy, thank you so much.
Nope. We're losing you, Sarah. Hello?
What was the takeaway from that for you?
Can you guys hear me?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, a little bit.
Hello?
No. Hello?
Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay.
I'm here.
Could you guys hear Sarah the whole time?
I think we're all here.
Okay. Go ahead. I'm so sorry. Nope.
I can hear you.
Are you hearing this, Jeff?
Hello?
And where you go from here?
Actually, the biggest takeaway that really took me back was whenever they walked through just the raw numbers for how many women are in the media. And they looked at the 2012 election versus the 2016 election, where I think commentators on television, it was something like 23% were women in 2012. And I think we went up to 28%. In 2016,
wow.
The best performing media outlet who allows women on the air more than any other is NPR. And they do it to the tune of, wait for it, 30%.
Wow. That's amazing.
Wow.
And the most shocking is that whenever they talk about issues like women's health, access to abortion, and women's rights, I think even the numbers for that were like only, I think, below 35% of the commentators were women.
Wow.
That's shameful.
Yeah. And we wonder why it's 13 white men in a room crafting health policy.
That's exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. So the work that they're doing is so important. And I think just being able to get more, amplify women's voices has been important. This week, I have tried to, I made a list of badass women on Twitter. And my goal for the week was trying to not retweet any men and to just retweet out only women. That's just awesome. To see if, you know, to, and sometimes it was hard because you're like, oh shit, that's really good. I want to retweet that, but it's by a dude. Let me see if I can find something similar that a woman is.
Well, that's awesome. Speaking of, did you see the out of Roosevelt Institute, Justice Doesn't Trickle Down, this new report written by Andrea Flynn about racialized and gendered rules holding women back?
No, tell us about it.
Okay, so first of all, the Roosevelt, this was came out of Roosevelt Institute, but it was, I believe, funded, the underwriting or part of the underwriting, or it was done in conjunction with the Ms. Foundation. Okay. So they relied upon a lot of the, essentially the stories that had been collected and that kind of thing by the Ms. Foundation when they were talking about specific, you know, in order to personalize something. But the data comes out of hardcore academic studies. So there are some just, I mean, they're horrifying statistics that come out of this thing, and I'm not all the way through it because it's 90 something pages and it dropped yesterday and, you know, I have a real job.
Right.
But overall, women earn $418,000 less over a 40-year lifespan or work span, and it takes them 10 years to catch up to what men earn. But here's the trick. That's also racialized because while white women earn $565,640 less than men, Latina women earn $1,043,800 less. Do over a 40-year work span and have to work 34 more years to catch up.
Wow. That's extraordinary.
Yeah. So this, what this incredible report at, you know, and I'm only like 45 pages into it, but what this, this push from the far left, from the, you know, from the bro, Bernie bro left of the party to abandon identity politics in favor of, you know, gender neutral, racially neutral, economic issue based politics is flawed at its very base. That the foundational fact that economic issues are always, always filtered through identity and through the identity of gender and race has to be part of how we talk about this. That intersectionality, a deep and broad intersectionality, has to be at the essential core of how we talk about issues going forward in the Democratic Party.
And we have to start calling people out and saying it's frankly racist to not be intersectional. To imagine a world in which we just say, oh, well, it, you know, that's not important to talk about those issues because, you know, economic equality will fix everything is privileged, morally bankrupt and racist.
Yes. And can we make a point about the whole framing of the idea of identity politics in the first place? Because what are we really saying when we say identity politics? What we're saying is that white men are the norm.
Right.
And everything else outside the norm. It is absolutely racist and gendered on its base to even say, to even frame the debate that way.
Right.
Yeah. You're completely right.
Absolutely.
One of the things that Stephen Colbert, I remember whenever he was playing that Republican, you know, character on Comedy Central, is he used to always, you know, look into the camera and with a straight face say, well, I don't see race. Right. I don't see race.
Yeah.
And it's really difficult because I think that a lot of people, he grew up in South Carolina. Like, he's the most liberal dude that there is, and he completely understands the race issue. So when people really, like, got really pissed at him for saying that, they were like, no, people see race. This is a real thing. He was like, yeah, no, I'm playing a right-wing Republican character.
Right.
This is what they think. This is how they view it. It's like, oh, well, I don't really see your color. You know, I'm pretty, you know, whatever. And it's, he captured that. He was saying that to kind of show off the fact that of how absurd it is,
right,
to say that.
He would say, like, I know that I'm white because
young
people
white
tell
men
me that
in
I
our
am.
Party. Yeah.
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 And a crap ton of young white men in our party would say the same thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they would.
Yes, they would, because they don't understand that, like, black people do not want to hear you say, I don't see race. That completely wipes away every part of what they go through on a daily basis that we don't understand. And to say, well, I don't see race, is like saying, I don't think that your experience is valid or real and that it couldn't possibly be that different from mine. It's an incredibly offensive thing to say.
Yeah.
And ignoring race and ignoring gender, and by gender, I mean the broad definition of that. In other words, gender identity and all of those other things, is ignoring the ocean in which all of these other issues swim. All of these economic issues swim in the ocean of, you know, who you are, mm-hmm. basically.
And where you come from.
Yeah, and how the world experience. Looks at you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how mm-hmm. the world sees you and your lived experience. And it is absolutely essential that we not allow this party to, progressives in general, to go down the rabbit hole, and I can speak as an authority on rabbit holes.
Narf, narf.
That's right. That we not allow this party to go down the rabbit hole of neutrality.
Yes.
It's not acceptable.
I completely agree.
And, you know, one of the other things I saw that crossed my, you know, sort of visible plane of things was a thing from Southern Poverty Law Center, an email they sent out this week. In 2016, the Government Accountability Office said that the number of high poverty schools serving primarily people of color more than doubled between 2001 and 2014.
God, isn't that...
Segregation is increasing.
That's right.
Yeah.
And nearly half of all black students attend majority black schools.
Yes.
Yes. And another report that's been circulating in my mind, and I don't know if you all caught this, but NPR and ProPublica did a deep dive into the maternal death rates in America. And it was, I rage cried. I will tell you that, because what a disservice we're doing to our women in healthcare. And I know, you know, these, again, I love how you said that, Arliss, that it's this ocean in which all these other issues swim, because, you know, the outcomes for women, and especially women of color, and are astoundingly poor, because not only because of the, you know, the stratification of economics, but also because of how we view the humanity of the people we live with in this country.
Right.
And here's the kicker on that study, by the way, that the women of color are at a higher risk of death during pregnancy, regardless of income or education.
Right. Yep.
Because we have
regardless of income or education.
Yep.
Because it's about their humanity. It's about how do doctors interact with these people? What are their internal biases, and how important are these women of color as compared to white women? What is the value of their life, and what is their humanity, essentially?
And then women in general, and compared to men, because, you know, and we've had many conversations about this, you know, women's experiences going to the doctor and just telling, you know, expressing what's wrong and being minimized and diminished and sidelined. And, you know, these women go and they have these babies, and, you know, they're completely, their health is just ignored. And it's been a soapbox of mine for a long time. I'm very candid to say I suffered from pretty significant postpartum depression after I delivered my daughter. And I, you know, there was nothing for me. There was not this, network of support. No, you know, when I took my daughter to her well child visits, no one was asking me how I was.
Right.
And, you know, and it's just such a, it's just so ingrained in our culture about, women, you know, being respected and being taken seriously when they have issues or problems, and it literally kills women.
Yeah.
And it costs us our lives when this, you know, it goes across fields, but healthcare, especially just right now is in my head, and it's shameful. It's really shameful.
It is.
It's, and in with my recent surgery, I recently had major league surgery, and when I met what turned out to be my second surgeon, because there's a whole thing with the first surgeon. Anyway, when I met the second surgeon, I realized that from the way he was speaking to me, I got frustrated initially very quickly because he was speaking to me, you know, like a kindergartner. And I said to him, I need to stop you. And this is like 30 seconds into knowing this man. I said, I need to stop you. I have a PhD right? in physics from MIT. And my husband, who's sitting right here, has a master's in biology. You need to talk to us like we know what you're saying.
Good for you.
And his literally his entire approach changed at that moment in time. You could see him. I mean, the way he carried his body changed.
Yeah.
It was remarkable. And I got to say, this man was a fabulous surgeon. He did an amazing job. I had an incredibly positive outcome. Good for him. But he handles every woman like he handled me when that started.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And every woman doesn't walk in, you know, loaded for bear like I did.
Right.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. And or know how to advocate for themselves. And, you know, I think one of the things I took out of that study and just, you know, and it's been percolating in my mind for a long time is, you know, how do we help women talk to one another and empower one another to stand up for themselves when they experience this, when they encounter this? Because, you know, when you're sick and, you know, you're already feeling vulnerable, you know, to be diminished and dismissed and minimized is, you know, it's a horrible experience. You know, I had a similar situation back in 2012, and I sat in an ER for over 10 hours, and they were going to send me home. And, you know, I eventually had to have emergency surgery, and I almost died, and all these things happened to me. But I just remember the doctors just being very, you know, especially in the ER, not when I was finally admitted to the hospital, but in the ER, they were just very dismissive and let me sit for a long time. And it was just, I don't know, you're already feeling like you're burdening, you know, women have this thing about we burden people, yes. You know, and so you're already feeling like you're burdening somebody. And then to be treated like that is just, it's just very defeating.
Yes. And it kills people.
Well, my sister, who she's a wonderful human, but she barely has a high school education. So she's not going to be the kind of person who naturally does an awesome job advocating for herself, you know, in the with medical professionals, sat in a waiting room in an emergency, you know, at a hospital in the emergency room and nearly bled to death sitting there. She finally passed out, and the friend who had taken her to the emergency room went over to the desk and said, "My friend just passed out and there's blood everywhere. Doesn't somebody want to see her?"
God.
At which point in time, the hospital finally figured out that, ooh, maybe we ought to do something about that.
Yeah.
God.
When I was a teenage girl, I was about, at the time, 17 to 24. I tried and tried and tried to tell doctors that something was wrong with me, and I was in pain all of the time, and I really, something's going on, and I'm really in a lot of pain all the time, and it's not normal, and it's not just PMS, and it's something's really wrong. And by the time they started, and they just always blew me off. Oh, just go home and take some Midol and put on a heating pad, and I'm sure you're fine, and you're just being hysterical, and whatever. And by the time they figured out what was going on, I have endometriosis, and I had 7 cysts rupture on my left ovary. I passed out. I went to the hospital. They did an ultrasound, found those 7 cysts, and then also found that several of my organs had been scarred together from lack of treatment of the endometriosis, and I had to have surgery to get my organs to remove themselves from each other. So, that, I mean, it's just extraordinary. Jesus. Yeah, no one believed me for like
and 7 we're years. White.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And we're white.
Yes. So now take that and do the multiplier on that.
Yep.
And you know, multiply it by people of color, women of color, and then multiply it by
people
income.
Who don't have insurance. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then, that's why people die. That's why we have such a garbage rate of, it's horrible.
Yeah. So can I rant for a second?
Sure.
There is an author who I believe is now a vice chancellor at Oxford, but her name is Louise Richardson, and she has written a book on, she wrote a book quite some time ago on terrorism, how terrorists think, in other words, and she kind of divided them into two groups, apocalyptic terrorists and pragmatic terrorists, or what she called temporal terrorists. And the difference between these two is that basically a temporal terrorist, a pragmatic terrorist wants something specific. It's like the IRA. If you give them Northern Ireland, they're done. They go home. They're done.
Right.
It's like, okay, enough said, done. But apocalyptic terrorists, they just want to burn the world down.
Yeah.
They are coming from a place of rage and arrogance and psychopathy, and they just want to burn the world down.
Yeah.
I am tired. I am so exhausted, so tired of being at the mercy of apocalyptic men, whether they are shooting, children and, parents in an arena in the UK, or, terrorizing women online in the U.S., prior to the election, or for that matter, at caucuses in caucus states, or, I am exhausted dealing with the rage and arrogance of men that comes out as violence.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do about it. I'm just
a fucking man.
I am so far beyond, because this is everything from, as far as I'm concerned, it's everybody from, what I think of as the white rage movement here in, the U.S. and a number of the Bernie bros to Al-Qaeda. I mean, I see that all in the same spectrum at this point in time. I have been pushed far enough by their just unrelenting, unmitigated, illogical, constant rage dump that I just don't even know what to do with myself around that anymore.
Yeah.
Thoughts?
Well, I think, as the mom of a 12-year-old girl who's taking her daughter to see her very first concert in just a few months, the Manchester bombing and just the targeted, that was not a random attack, right? It was very specifically targeted toward women, toward girls, toward the LGBTQ community.
Yeah.
And it just, I have so much sorrow and also just exactly that, just this anger and this exhaustion at the white, white male and male rage in general towards women being human.
Yes.
And everybody is appalled and devastated at the Manchester attack, but moms and daughters and girls and, it eats away at me in a way I can't even describe, because it's like, it just makes me want to take her to even more shows because I'm just so fucking angry about it. Because it's just, fuck you. No, we get to live our lives the way that we want to. And this world doesn't belong to you anymore. And you can rage about it all you want, and we're going to keep doing it.
Well, that's the point, right? I think that's where so much of this rage comes from, is the world isn't the way it used to be, and I'm pissed about it, and I don't feel like it's not fair, right? It's not fair that it's not the way that it used to be anymore. And how come ladies get to talk so much? And why can't I say what I want to say? And why can't I grab what I want to grab? And why can't I? Why can't I? It's not fair. I don't, you know, at least for me, like, that's where I get a lot of the male rage directed toward me. But again, I kind of agree with you, Arliss. Like, it does seem to me that when we talk about mass shootings or suicide bombings or bombings in general or online harassment or street harassment or sexual assault or whatever, it does seem to be this really specific kind of male, apocalyptic male rage, just shitting all over everything because fuck everything.
Yeah. And I think one of the things...
You remember the school shooting in San Bernardino, not the terrorist thing, but he had a history of domestic violence and a manifesto of anti-woman rage that I think, I mean, you have to wonder at this point, like, how many terrorists come from this world of, like, who have these, like, this inner sort of anti-woman rage, because it seems like a lot of them have a lot of social media that seems to, you know, promote this kind of women subjugation and I'm a victim because of feminism kind of ideology.
Right.
Yep. And the number one predictor of violence towards strangers is a history of domestic violence.
Yeah.
That they are so highly correlated that you can, that it is, not often in science do they say that it is predictive, but it is one of those events that, you know, across multiple studies and meta studies that they've looked at, that is the thing, right? And it's just so telling that violence that starts at home toward women and toward the vulnerable just gets magnified and spread around, and yet we do nothing about it. And it just continues to be, women are not only victimized at home, they're victimized when they report. You know, there was just a story out that a woman had done everything right. She had done everything that she was supposed to do, tried to file a restraining order, and it was denied. And 2 days later, she was dead in her home. Yep. And it happens over and over and over again. And all we do is say thoughts and prayers, and we still don't take domestic violence seriously. And yet it is one of those things that we know leads to, not only is it horrifying on its face and a crime on its face, but it also leads to bigger and more crime in our communities.
And pivoting off that, this is interesting. I was going to talk about this article earlier, but women are now living with fear of deportation if they report domestic violence. There was a new survey that was done that provides data that demonstrates a noticeable shift in immigrant survivors' contact with victim services providers. So this was a 2017 advocate and legal service survey regarding immigrant survivors. It was conducted by a coalition of national organizations focused on domestic violence and sexual assault. They collected responses from roughly 700 advocates and attorneys from 46 states and Washington, D.C., asking them about the issues confronting immigrant survivors seeking services and information about specific incidents. Here are some of the highlights. 62% of respondents, a group that includes both social and legal service providers, said they have seen an increase in immigration-related questions from survivors. So they're coming to these people for help because they've been a victim of domestic violence or sexual assault. And the 62% of these people said that they're seeing a huge increase in them asking questions about immigration to the people that are trying to help them with domestic violence. 78% of respondents said that survivors had expressed concerns about contacting police due to fears that it would open them up to deportation. 75% said that survivors had expressed concerns about going to court for a matter related to their abuser, a concern that was likely exacerbated by the highly reported courthouse arrest of a domestic violence victim seeking a protective order against her abuser earlier this year. 43% of respondents also said that the survivors they have worked with dropped criminal and civil cases related to their abuse because they were fearful of potentially opening themselves up to law enforcement. or to deportation enforcement. So that's just, let's just pile on, right?
Well, I listened to, and I don't remember where, I don't remember what podcast this was, but I listened to several mayors from different major cities across the U.S. talking about the sanctuary city issue. And I think it was the mayor, current mayor of Los Angeles, I want to say, that was saying, hey, you know, I need to stop this whole discussion about why we do this for social and moral reasons. He said, because that's not why LA did it. I mean, all those things are true. He said, and all, you know, that's all true. But we did it because it makes every single citizen in Los Angeles safer.
That's right.
That's right.
When immigrants can report crime, can they be witnesses to crime, they do. And that makes every other citizen in the city safer.
That's right.
He said, you know, my police chief and, you know, my sheriff, you know, all of those people are absolutely behind the sanctuary city movement, not because they're, you know, social liberals, but because they are pro-law enforcement and this gets them where they want to go.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
In Denver, Mayor Hancock and the Denver Police Department and the Denver City Attorney's Office are very much behind this because ICE agents have been spotted and video recorded at Denver County courthouses arresting people who are going to court either as witnesses or for minor violations. And they're tackling them inside the courthouse and arresting them and deporting them. And the mayor and the sheriff's department and the city police have said, please stop. Please stop. The city attorney, Kristen Bronson, came out and said, look, we've had 4 women drop serious domestic violence cases recently, like in the last month, because they're afraid of going to court because they're afraid they're going to get deported. Like, you're hurting the citizens of Denver. You're hurting our ability to enforce laws. You're hurting our ability to prosecute criminals. You're hurting our ability to do our jobs and keep the people of the city safe. Please stop. And I said, no. They said the courthouse is a great place to be because people have to go to through security so that we know that they don't have weapons and that they're safe. We know when they're going to be there, and we know who they are. And they're like, basically, fuck you. And so they're trying to get creative around what kind of rules they can make in the courthouse and all kinds of other things. But really, there's nothing we can do to stop them from enforcing it. It's just barbaric.
Yeah.
I know.
I mean, I have no place to go from there in my head. I mean, it's just...
Yeah.
I had a situation, it's about 2 or 3 years ago. For my job, I do a lot of work it's lessened now, but at the time I was doing a lot of work in human trafficking. And one of the main avenues that traffickers use to traffic their girls is Craigslist. Yeah. And Craigslist and Backpage and those sorts of online sites. And so one evening I was looking through Craigslist, just kind of, you know, seeing what was out there, seeing how this was all going. And I came across this extremely violent, speaking of the San Bernardino attack, I came across this extremely violent, very graphic posting of this young male. I don't know his race, but this young male who was essentially threatening to do a San Bernardino, very angry, very long. I'm going to fuck a bunch of women and then I'm going to kill them all. And it was visceral. And I didn't quite know what to do with it. And my friend who works for the city of Aurora said, you need to call the PD. So I did. And I filed a report and I printed it all out. And the officer shows up to take this report, right? And just getting out of his car, I could tell he was annoyed that he was even at my house. And so he comes up to the door and I'm like, so this is what's going on. And he's like, and this is literally what he said to me. He said, well, what's a nice girl like you doing on Craigslist anyway? If you go looking for it, you're gonna find it. Yep. So the officer refused to take my report. I had it all printed out and he's like, well, there's nothing I can do with this. And it's all over the internet. It's not a big deal. It's not targeted towards you. And if you go looking for this stuff on Craigslist, you know, basically you slut shaming, you know, cause thinking that I'm like, you know, searching around for a man or something. And it was just so, it was horrifying and so dismissive. And, you know, I reported him to a supervisor and all of that. But if that's the experience of a woman who I'm pretty, you know, educated, I can advocate for myself. Right. I know what my resources are. I know what my outlets are and I can push forward. Right. But a woman who just, you know, is living her life as a single mom and, you know, tries to do the right thing, tries to say, you know, this is something I found to be treated like that was just, it was horrifying.
Wow.
It was awful. Wow. Yeah. So if that's what's happening when women are trying to report this stuff, they're just being told that they're making too big a deal of it, or
it's just the internet, right?
Boys, yeah,
be just boys.
You know, mm-hmm. Boys can be boys. That's exactly the attitude, yep. And it was just so eye-opening, wow, to me that was the experience that people are having, even with their local police.
Yeah, wow, that's horrifying. I mean,
yeah.
It's like when, you know, that we had that whole thing with that creepy guy from calling me at work and calling me on my cell phone and all of that. The first time I reported it, the cop was looking at me like, what do you want me to do with this information? He was like, do you want to make a report? Or like, does it? And I was like, yeah. He was like, okay.
Because if the fucker shows up to my house with a gun.
Yes.
I would like to be there.
For if
there
this to be escalates, I'd like there to be a record of how it's escalating. And eventually it got popped up the food chain quite a bit. But that first response was exactly that. He was annoyed to be there on a Friday afternoon. And please don't make me write this down. Like, I really don't want to. It's like, all too bad. You know.
It's really hard for me in situations like that not to get incredibly condescending. I'm like, is there like a higher IQ officer, like a woman? Is there like somebody who's not lazy and Barney Five-ish
that I could talk to maybe, or
a professional officer instead of a mall cop?
Exactly. Yeah. I almost ended up. I also would say to that guy, I can tell why you're on the beat, man. I can tell why you're patrolling around doing this stuff, because you obviously, it was hard for me to, I mean, I was so shocked by it, you know, because my daughter is standing right there. And so, you know, just to have, it was just so, you know, shaming and I was really embarrassed, you know, but then I got angry. So. Yeah. Anger is always better to act on in those situations.
Yeah. So true.
Yes.
Shit happens when I'm pissed.
Exactly.
Okay. My staff, when there's some kind of issue with a vendor or something like that, my staff has a common line. They tell me to, you know, whoever problem vendor, you don't want to have to talk to my boss. You don't want her calling you.
Exactly.
That's awesome.
You're going to have a bad day. So you want to solve this problem with me, which entertains me.
That's awesome.
That's awesome.
Okay, I want to pivot really quick to something that kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier, but that just made me want to burn the world down. Ben Carson. Anybody hear about this week? Ben Carson does an interview. The Secretary of HUD, Housing and Urban Development, this man is responsible for people. Let me just back up. Okay. Ben Carson, Secretary of HUD, did an interview this week in which he said, quote, I think poverty to a large extent is a state of mind. You take somebody who has the right mindset, you can take everything from them and put them on the street, and I guarantee in a little while they'll be right back up there. He's so eloquent. Quote, and you take somebody else with the wrong mindset, you can give them everything in the world, they'll work their way right back down to the bottom. So.
I mean, if you think about it, that's kind of Donald Trump right there.
Yep. That's their entire operating philosophy.
If you look at the way that he spent, no, I mean, like personally, if you look at the way that he spends money, he operates as though he is a rich man. And I think once his taxes come out, we're going to find out he's a poor man.
Yeah.
But for all of that seems to be like people who have money, you know, or want to pretend they have money can pretend it. But people who don't have money, we're just continuously oppressed. And you still have to claw your way back up. And this idea, I mean, look at it this way. Ben Carson is really known for his eloquence. and I say that in jest, but if like the way that he says things with such self-assurance,
there's such a huge segment of the population who heard that and was just like, oh yeah, totally, totally.
Yeah, totally. And
here's
the fact that he's a black guy saying it makes them go, see, we're not racist. See,
right.
It's not, it's we're the, not racist. The black guy
they don't
even
see
says
that color.
That, no, of course not. The black guy says that black people are just lazy. So it's not me. Right.
So back to where I started in all of this today, which is this report, Justice Does Not Trickle Down.
Yep.
They have six key arguments. Number five in their list of key arguments is inequality is not a choice made by the marginalized. It is the result of actions, laws, and policies enacted by the wealthy and powerful. And then they lay out that argument in great detail.
That is perfectly said. Perfect.
You know, you remember when Michelle Obama did the speech where she talked about how it is our job as women to, once we get through the door, to make sure that we're holding it open for the person behind us.
Yeah.
I feel like Ben Carson violates that so well.
So profoundly, like, yeah.
So profoundly, like his level of stupidity is just like a new level. You know, it's like one that had to be specially created just for him.
No. He has a role model. All you have to do is look at the Supreme Court.
Yep. Clarence Thomas.
Yeah. Yeah. People talk about
Clarence
people
Thomas
who slammed the door
is, yes.
Him.
Yeah.
Yeah. I made it out of poverty, and now all the social programs that helped me and allowed me to make it out of poverty, I would like to shut them all down.
Yep. And you wonder, like, is that just about you wanting to maintain your own status, or is that because it goes against this idea of you pulling yourself up by your bootstraps?
That's what it is.
Like, somehow it's not, you know, it's not, it takes a village. Somehow it's, you know, no, it just takes my perseverance.
It
no,
was really me.
It really does take a village. We are not in some kind of closed economic system, you know, like other people's actions and other people's tax dollars impact your life and impact your upbringing and give you access to, you know, a better community, a stronger community, a more economically, you know, viable community. And if you are not a part of that, then I feel like that's where Ben Carson gets completely off, is it's just, he sees, it's almost like housing and urban development. You know, he just thinks about it within the context of how can I keep these systems closed? Like, how can I just maintain the status quo? And he's not interested in actually developing communities. He just wants to develop himself and his own ideology. And
I think he's saying, like, even though my mom maybe used some of those things, that's not why I got out of poverty. I got out of poverty because I'm a special snowflake. I'm extraordinary. And so if you're like me, you can be extraordinary too, even though he is completely blind to the idea that if his mother did not have access to those social programs, he would not be where he is. But he can't admit that because then he's not special.
And I think we're getting to the, I mean, not to get too philosophical, right? But we're getting to that really toxic, unique American idea of the prosperity doctrine.
Yeah,
that, right.
You know, if you have it, you earned it, and you're better. And if you don't, you're lazy and dumb and awful, and you deserve to be where you're at. And it really is, you know, I've been spending time with a new paramour, I suppose, from Canada. And it's just so interesting to talk about this idea of how America sees itself and how it sees its people. And we are not a country that says that each of us deserves to have security and health and well-being and prosperity. We're a country that is very punitive and small-minded in a lot of ways when it comes to these issues. And it's unfortunate because it hurts us all in the long run, but there's just some smug satisfaction that this individualist prosperity doctrine folk get out of seeing other people suffer. And it is toxic. It will be something that America will fall under if we don't start to really acknowledge that.
It goes back
to apocalyptic rage arrogance, right. psychopathy.
But it goes back to the Puritans, really, because what we're saying, like, this has been ingrained in our culture since we started. The Puritans believed that if you worked hard and you know, work was everything, right? Work, your labor and your spirit, that was everything. That made you either good or bad. And we've kind of translated that into, if you have things, that must mean that you worked hard and therefore you are a moralist, a good person. And people who don't have a lot must not have worked hard and must be bad people. We actually attach morality to wealth.
Yes.
And that is, right. I think, the fundamental flaw in the system.
And there's a solid study out that shows that wealth is a much, much greater predictor of financial stability and success than income.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes, assets.
It didn't need to be that way. I remember that.
Yeah, they are not the same thing. Wealth and income are not the same thing.
Right. I feel like that was something that we found, like, that uptick happened. I remember whenever I was in college, where all of a sudden the inequality really started to grow a lot, you know, during the recession. And just like, oh, great. Yeah. I'm not from wealth. I'm screwed.
Yep. Exactly. All right. On that note, ladies, let's take a break really quick and we'll be right back. Welcome back. This is a special episode of Irreverent Testimony. It's actually Irreverent Testimony is hosting our newest podcast, a spinoff called No Boys Allowed. Today we have with us Arliss Bunny from Hopping Mad, Molly, and Sarah Burris from Raw Story. Arliss, you had something you wanted to talk about real quick.
Oh, yeah. Today, Saturday the 27th, we're recording this on Saturday the 27th, and it is the feast day of Saint Melangel, I believe, M-E-L-A-N-G-E-L. I'm not Catholic. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but he is the patron saint of rabbits and hares. Oh, so today is the feast day for our patron saint.
That's adorable.
That's wonderful. Okay. That's adorable.
Happy forth all of the carrots and lettuce of the land.
Yes.
That's right. That's right.
That's right. I was like, I don't know what the greeting is for that, but happy rabbit saint day. There we go.
Pop on.
There you go. There's a carrot juice kegger at my place tonight. A rabbit rate.
Okay. So I want to address kind of the elephant in the room for some people that may be listening to this, which is that we are four white ladies sitting around talking. And one of the things I wanted to make a goal of this podcast was not to have it be about white feminism and not to have it be, I think part of our job as women and as white women in particular, is to address the problem of white women, to talk to each other and to sort of talk about some of the things that plague our community in terms of race. So a friend of ours, friend of the show, Jermaine, posted this recently on Facebook, and I'm just going to read it, and then I want to talk about it. He says, paraphrase from my friend Lakeisha Robinson, quote, I can totally understand why those who partake in the sweet nectar of whiteness, I bet it tastes like organic honey, job satisfaction, payday, and paid leave, my mouth is watering, feel triggered at the mention of appropriation. If whiteness is inherently more valuable than everything else in comparison, then that dance isn't awesome or valuable until a white kid does it. Black and brown people have to remain invisible or silent, or we might actually have to start caring about the systemic violence of the status quo. So the Harlem Shake isn't a phenomenon until some white kids jerk strangely on YouTube. Whiteness is like Pac-Man. Appropriation is the fruit Pac-Man eats so he can gobble up other cultures' music and food and discard the shells without remorse. Please don't try to explain the ghost's backstory and the significance or remind me that they didn't volunteer to participate in the game. I just want to steal their tortilla recipe and sell a version to my friends for $12. It's an incredible burden to consider that the way that I consume culture and earn a living hurt actual people. Let me lock my hair in peace without the sob story of the girls from Massachusetts who can't wear their natural hair to school. Thoughts?
It's funny that you bring this up now, because one of the things I did, since I just spent basically the far better part of 8 weeks trapped in bed recovering from surgery, was that I did a bunch of reading. And what I chose to read about were issues surrounding people of color, specifically, because I feel so undereducated and so inarticulate and so distant from any, you know, from being able to even be at sort of a kindergarten level of understanding how I can participate in improving things.
Right.
And, you know, of course, the very beginning of that is, you know, shut the fuck up and listen.
Right.
But so I've been doing a lot of reading and listening to podcasts of, you know, people of color, and just trying to start to do a better job, because I have really focused on other kinds of things in my sort of educational life. I've focused on international issues. I've focused on business issues. I've focused on economics. I've focused on, but I have not really focused on a lot of social issues. It's not that they're not important to me. They haven't been centered for me. And so I decided to very consciously center these things and make an effort to get better informed, because it is not the responsibility of people of color to educate me. It's
right.
My responsibility to educate me.
Yep. Yes.
And that's really complex. And I'm finding that even, you know, sorting through what I should read and what I should listen to and what makes sense is difficult for me, because it's all affected by the filter I'm already wearing.
Right. Right.
And it does bring to mind, and I sent you all this tweet last night, but I think it does highlight sort of that idea, the microcosm of whiteness and white privilege. You know, this a guy on Twitter, his name is Keith Boykin, wrote a tweet last night, and he said, "No Democrat has won the majority of the white vote since 1964, when Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act. Of course, it's about race. Racism is the glue that held the country together. As long as both parties were a bit racist, we could build bridges and dams and highways. When both parties were a little bit racist, government could do big things like Social Security, Medicare, and the GI Bill on a bipartisan basis. Shortly after the Democrats aligned with the Civil Rights Movement in 1964-65, government became the enemy for many white voters. After signing the 1964 Civil Rights Act, Lyndon Johnson reportedly told Bill Moyers that Dems would lose the South for many years to come." And he goes on to talk about Nixon exploiting white fears with the Southern Strategy, Reagan using the welfare queens, Bush using Willie Horton. This has been going on, and we avoid this topic, you know, because I don't know that we avoid it, but the whole idea of identity politics, right? Racism is so foundational to how we identify as Americans that I don't know how you divvy that out. I don't know where we're ever going to get if we don't really start to grapple with the deep-seated, you know, all the way back to the foundations of the country, the deep-seated racism that we have in all of our institutions. You know, I work in child welfare, and we talk about racial disparity in child welfare is astronomical. We have more reports, more assessments, more cases, and more removals of kids going into foster care of children of color than any other, and far disproportional to their representation in the general population. And it's a huge issue, and it goes to the heart of who we are as Americans. And I don't know how we don't talk about it. I don't know how you get to a place where you say, oh, it's about economics. It's so much ingrained in us.
It is, and that's what I think that's why I want to have this conversation, is like, we can talk about the bigger structural issues. But to Arliss's point, like, it is our job as white people to not only educate ourselves about what life is like and the struggles of people of color, but also to talk to other white people about it and try to come to a place where we do not, that we can try to get rid of whiteness, that we can try to get rid of this idea that whiteness is the norm, is the is the best thing. And I'm with Arliss. Like, I, you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about this stuff and reading about it and reading from people of color. And I still am in a place where I'll, of course, never understand. But I think it's something that we should talk about in our own lives, our own biases, our own, you know, privilege, and how that looks and what we can do to dismantle it. Because that's my goal. I'm what you'd call a white traitor. I want to dismantle whiteness. I do. I do. Yeah. I think that it's toxic, and I think that it's that's my goal. So I just want to start that conversation, I guess. And it's probably going to be uncomfortable, and we'll probably mess some things up. But I think it's our job to be open about it and talk about it and try to at least internally first dismantle it, and then hopefully, you know, make movement.
So the other.
Oh, I was just going to say, one of the big shifts in conversation that we've had in the social work field is moving away from this idea of cultural competence, quote unquote, to cultural humility. And it's a really important concept because it's not just words. It's this actual idea that we'll never be competent. I'm never going to read a book and know how to work with an African-American family, right? Because they're all completely different. They're all individual people. Right. But if you walk in with this idea of humility, that's the place to start the conversation.
Right.
True. Which is kind of how I deal with everything, because I inevitably will humiliate myself with anybody. So I generally approach every situation as, I have no idea what any of y'all are dealing with. So how can I be helpful? And I think that's the one thing. I mean, I'm glib about it because I try to be funny instead of crying about issues, but which is how I feel like everybody wants to, what everybody wants to do these days is just be so sad about everything. But we, I think we have an opportunity if we can just approach every situation with, tell me how to be helpful. Like, what can I do? And ask other people, like, as a, you know, white lady, what is it that you need from me that can be helpful in moving, you know, in fixing this one thing today?
Right.
We'll talk about the world tomorrow and in the future, but today, how can I help you?
Right. I did hear someone say, and I can't remember who it was, but they, some person of color said, as a response to the question, what can we do to fix this? They said, holy shit, if you don't know how to fix this, I don't know why you're looking at me. And I was like, shit. Yeah. Like, we created this problem, right? We created this problem. Huh?
We should just start breeding with each other. I mean, and just get rid of white people. Like, everybody needs to be have some kind of color in them. Come on. Let's just do it.
But that, you know, I read another report this week, and it's from, I just opened the report up so I would have the right information, and it's from Indian Country, which is a media network, and they put out a report called Intergenerational Trauma, Understanding Natives' Inherited Pain.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that one of the reasons that I read this report is because my grandfather was 100% Native American. He was not, I mean, he was raised with a language other than English in his home.
Wow.
And I did not know that until I was 12 or 13 years old and visiting my grandparents in Kansas and overheard my grandfather on the phone with one of his siblings speaking in a language other than English. And I went back to the kitchen and I asked my grandmother about it. And she said, we don't talk about that in this house. Don't ask your grandfather about it. He doesn't want to talk about it. He doesn't want to, we don't talk about it. So, you know, I grabbed my mom, and my mom said, oh, well, we're Native American, and your grandfather is, you know, Native American, and it was really bad and hard for him, and he doesn't want to talk about it. So we don't talk about it ever.
Yeah. And I will say that working in child welfare, we have an incredibly sordid history of that we as a field are grappling with, you know, because a lot of what happened to Native Americans was as a result of the child welfare system coordinating with the racist governments to steal Indian children off of the, you know, from their families, put them in schools, erase their identity, literally erase their identity. And it is hard to be in this field and to hear people say, well, why do we have things like the Indian Child Welfare Act? You know, it's, and to really try to educate people on that intergenerational cultural trauma, that we are still participating in to this day. And it's something that we're not perfect at, but I do think we're at least having conversations about it with our new workers, with people coming into the field. You know, there's no greater power that you have than to walk into a family's home and take their children. Mm-hmm. And if we're not doing that in a way that is culturally sensitive to the history, to the understanding of our role, then we are just participating in the white supremacy that has happened for generations prior to us.
We've been dealing with the same thing in my family. I've been back home in Oklahoma trying to deal with a whole bunch of family issues. And oddly enough, while I was there, somebody from the Chickasaws reached out to me on my website and was like, hey, we have a whole bunch of Burrises in the tribe. Do you know if you're Chickasaw? And we actually were Choctaws. So I never knew anything about the Chickasaws, and I was like, well, hell, I don't know. I mean, I can reach out to my aunt who does our genealogy stuff, and we can figure out like where, who might've married whom and, you know, how this works. And what was so interesting is she was like, well, we don't know what my mother was because she refused to talk about it. We know that her last name is something that we thought was Cherokee, but we can't really figure out where she comes from because she was so scared whenever she got married about being Native that she just refused to, you know, say where, what tribe she was in or where she was from or where her family was from, and just never told any of us. So we've basically been unable to find that whole side of our family, because she would never, ever, ever tell anybody out of fear. And that was really like, always sort of, I mean, when you grow up in Oklahoma, being Native or being like, everybody has some Native somewhere in them just because it's the nature of growing up there. And you grow up hearing stories, and you grow up hearing, you know, one tribe or another, and going to all kinds of different events just out of the fact that you're in the area, you know, like you're just, that's what you do when you're in Oklahoma. And so it was really strange to sort of hear this as, you know, an ancestry being something that you're afraid of.
Right.
And I just never had experienced it like that. We celebrated it so much growing up, you know, as a community, as the state. Our Native history was something that was celebrated and highlighted, and it was awesome, and we felt really empowered by it. And then you go along and realize, oh shit, like this is really close to home now. Like, I mean, you hear the stories of how did we end up in Oklahoma, and my aunt was telling me too, like, well, we have family in Kentucky too. And I was like, we do? And she goes, yeah. And I was like, when did we end up with family in Kentucky? And she goes, well, they stopped.
Yeah.
Meaning when they were marched to Oklahoma, they stopped.
Right.
And it was like, oh my God. Like my body just kind of broke out in goose flesh. And I was like, okay, I'm going to need to take a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let that sink in.
Yeah.
And not even just like being afraid of revealing, but also because we removed so many Native children from their homes and erased their identities, those kids probably, I mean, there's probably entire generations of people who don't know because their identities were erased.
Well, and here's the trick in all of this. you know, science is telling us, and, you know, we've had an awful lot of science on the, you know, just in general, telling us that trauma and stress switches on particular genes, and then it becomes encoded.
Interesting.
Okay, so now let's go back to what happened really, actually, just a few generations ago to Native Americans. And those genes get switched on. It's literally encoded. That trauma is, to some degree, encoded.
In your genetics.
In your genetics. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And one of the most, and one of the things that we don't talk about Standing Rock, and mm-hmm. you know, Standing Rock was not just about oil. Mm-hmm. And it was, right? Because there was,
by the way, four breaches of the DAPL pipeline.
Yes, already. Yeah. You know, but one of the things that came out of that, that I've heard several people that I, you know, in my field talk about, was recapturing that identity and recapturing the connection to the, you know, to the pride in being Indigenous. And, you know, and it was a very powerful experience for a lot, especially a lot of young people, to be amongst their people, their tribes. And it was an experience of unity. And, you know, so it started with oil, and it is still about oil, but it is about so much more than that. And I think that's something to be celebrated. And I definitely think it's something for white people to stay the fuck away from. Yes. Like, it's fine to participate in if you are humble and respectful and shut the fuck up. But there were many stories coming out about, you know, these well, you know, well-intentioned white folk going up to Standing Rock and being intrusive. And I think that's something to really be aware of, is that if we go into these spaces as white people, being very conscientious of how we do that is and calling each other out when we're not is very important.
Yes.
We are not your fad.
Right. It's the same thing with the Black Lives Matter movement, right? You'd have all these well-meaning white people go to these rallies and talk to the press. And it's like, why don't you shut the fuck up and point the press toward a person of color who's standing there, maybe one of the organizers, or I don't know, just maybe it's not your job to talk about Black Lives Matter on TV. And yeah, the press is maybe going to come to you, and it's your job to go, oh, wow, no, I'm not the spokesperson for this, obviously. I'm just here in support. Maybe in support and of service is all you need to be.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Amen.
Yeah.
Yep. And we white people do like to make it about us, don't we? Every subject that comes up, you know, inevitably there's somebody, there's a white person who has an opinion and feels that opinion needs to be heard and shared and amplified.
Right. It's the same as mansplaining. It's white-splaining, right? Like, yeah. Yeah. It's got to be horrible. I hate being mansplained too. So, you know. I can only imagine how much worse it is.
Well, and, you know, as a professional who does have this responsibility, you know, it's never over. I mean, I do feel like there's this guilt and this shame that comes from being in this profession because, you know, we have such a history of cultural genocide and. Yeah. How do I, as, you know, one person working at this level, not only acknowledge that, but work actively to change it? And that's my responsibility, right? Like, that's where I have to step up to the plate and say, I'm not going to shut up.
Right.
And I'm not going to let these 22-year-old white girls come out of social work school without understanding, you know, or at least trying to understand the history of the field in which they work.
That's the important thing, I think. One of the important things is that you don't forget your own history. It's interesting. I've been doing some reading lately because there was this movie about Miss Evers Boys, I think is what it's called. But about, like, the medical profession has the same problem, right? In terms of the history of Black people and the whole treatment of syphilis back in the day, where they just basically let a bunch of Black people have syphilis and gave them placebo medication just to see what would happen in the advanced phases of syphilis. And it was horrifying. And there is a trauma in the Black community around the medical profession. There's a lot of mistrust. and I think people inside of these institutions now, just like social work, medicine, all of them have to look at their own history and say, okay, that happened, and we have to talk about it, and we have to talk about how it never happens again, but we can't sweep it under the rug, and we can't forget that it happened.
Well, but it's every one of us. So I own a company, and it is incumbent upon me to make sure that my corporate policies and that my enforcement of those policies is in keeping with my values.
Yeah.
And that these values are inclusive and balanced and that my perspective is bigger than just mine, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
So every one of us from, you know, whatever we do, we touch on this. It's not just, you know, particular professions. Every one of us touches, you know, we swim in an ocean of,
right,
you know, we swim in this ocean, as I was saying earlier, and all the time.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit about this when we did the last Girls Only podcast with the safety pin movement, right? Mm-hmm. And how there was this white defensiveness that came up around women of color, especially calling out white women and saying, mm-hmm. "This, you're not safe. 54% of you voted for Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. We're not going to forget that, and we're not going to forgive it, and we don't have to." And, you know, there was women just, it wasn't me. I've been working in the civil rights field for years, and it's just like, it's not about that. And you're anything but safe if the first time you get called out, you get defensive and indignant.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think it does tie into that, this idea that we white women have a problem, and we don't like to talk about it, but it's there.
Right. Right. That's why, you know, people throw around this white feminism as an insult, and it should be, because we do. We have this sort of short-sightedness and this very like insulated worldview a lot of time of, isn't it awful to be a lady? And look at how these men are treating me, and look at how awful it is to be a woman. And we forget that Black women are women too, but they're Black first. And the world sees them differently than it sees me. And they have an entirely, all women of color. And then you look at, you know, disabled women, or, I mean, there's just,
yep,
the magnitude of intersectionality, like Arliss was saying, is an ocean. And I think white women like to tread lightly on top and not look down, not look below the, yep, surface. And that's the problem that we have, and we have to address it.
Yeah, I remember when Ani DiFranco, who is, you know, widely regarded as being a huge feminist and, you know, very powerful woman in music, and, you know, lots of women are passionately, you know, in love with her and her stances and her activism. And she scheduled a concert on a plantation, and completely like a, you know, an old plantation. It was this like women's gathering, right? They were going to have this conference and a concert and all this stuff. And it was in a Southern plantation. And her perspective was, well, I want to reappropriate this space and all of these things.
My
and
God, it's not,
yeah. And women and women of color were like, how fucking dare you? And I just remember these threads, you know, of really activist white women, white feminists defending her and talking about how, you know, everyone was just being too sensitive and appropriate, you know, and yeah, it's like even someone of her stature in the feminist community could fuck up that bad,
yeah,
you know, uh-huh, like, and be so tone deaf. And yet we don't want to talk about it.
Right. We want to defend her. No. La, 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 la. It's not a thing. No. Don't call.
Well, and it's, I have all faith that something I have said, or many things I have said in this conversation somewhere, there are, you know, women who are women of color who are activists who are banging their heads against the wall going, oh my God, she's so stupid.
Oh yeah.
you know,
100%. But we, you know what, if we can't talk about it and we can't try to figure it out, like, it, I will apologize and I will do better every time I possibly can. I will do better. All I'm trying to do is do better. But
yeah,
we have to start having these conversations amongst ourselves, or it's just stick your fingers in your ears and scream la 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 and nothing gets better.
Yeah.
We have to do the very best that we can. And when we fuck up, we will apologize and do better and learn.
And I invite anyone who finds it appropriate to tell me in what way I have, you know, fucked up during this conversation.
Yes.
Arliss Bunny, at Arliss Bunny on Twitter.
Yeah, at Mad Mad.
I know I fucked up in this conversation just because I do it in all conversations.
And I think, you know, talking about that cultural humility, the willingness to be held accountable and called out, and always, you know, not getting on the defensive stance, it's the minimum amount we can do.
Yeah.
It's like the basic level of really being, really trying to work on this issue, because if you're getting defensive, it's because something somebody is saying to you is ringing true.
Yeah.
And it's incumbent upon all of us to look at that and say, what is it about this that is getting to the heart of my own issues, my own biases.
My own biases, exactly right. Yep. And that stuff is hard to look at, man. It is tough and it is emotionally brutal, but it is the only thing that's going to make a difference. If we can't even be honest with ourselves about what those biases are and try to combat them, how do we expect to, you know, fix institutional racism in this country? I mean, it's just, it the bare minimum is to, like you said, be humble, be willing to be called out, but really do try to dig deep and figure out what those are for you, because everybody's got them.
I was thinking, I reread March over this past couple of months, and, you know, the 3-volume set. And one of the things that struck me while I was reading it again was that if I had read it 10 years ago, I would have seen it as a historical document, you know, as something that's talking to me about history. Mm-hmm. But reading it in today's context, to me, it feels, I finally see that it is, that it is present, that it is here now, that it is a today story, not a historical story.
Right.
And I would not have recognized that to the same degree and in the same way 10 years ago. And that is all to the credit of Black Lives Matter, frankly.
Yes. I completely agree with that. Yeah,
history is now, and it's ever
been for people of color,
and it always has been.
We just are going, mm-hmm. I see.
Yeah.
You know, that's white blindness. Not new.
We have the privilege of being ignorant to our whiteness.
That's right.
And people of color have no such privilege. They are acutely aware of their non-whiteness from a very young age, because they have to be, because it's survival. And we get to, you know, talk about this esoterically and abstractly. And for people of color, it is their everyday lived experience. And I don't pretend that I will ever understand that, because I won't.
No.
But the least I can do is acknowledge that that is true for all of us.
Yeah, absolutely. 100% agree. Okay, well, thanks for having that uncomfortable conversation, but I think it's a good start to, you know, to talk about these things. Anybody have anything with a little levity we want to end with? Anything you want to talk about? Anything that makes you mad? Anything?
Is it my imagination, or is Melania Trump incredibly miserable?
Oh my God.
I mean, you watch that woman carry herself in public on this trip, and she looks, I mean, I don't feel bad for her, because, you know, she signed up for this in a big way. But, oh, my God, it's
miserable.
Staggering how miserable she looks. And to what a degree that, you know, when you, W, not my favorite guy, but even Laura, you know, Laura Bush was, you know, worked hard as a first lady and, you know, was a first lady to be proud of in her own way, in her own bubble. But, you know, but Melania Trump is, and her $51,000 jacket, by the way, I don't get it. I completely don't get it.
I don't think that she knew what she was signing. I think she thought, well, I'm going to marry this rich guy and things seem fine. And then all of a sudden, you know, he becomes president. And a couple of people have written about her where they've talked about how she is an incredibly private person. Like she does not, she controls her message. She controls the imagery. She controls everything. And she's used to this world where everything is very polished and airbrushed and fine and whatever. And now all of a sudden there's so much scrutiny, not just on her husband, but on her and then on her child too. And so there's this, I'm sure there's this like mama bear kind of need to protect. And I mean, people are talking about whether Barron Trump is maybe like on the spectrum and all kinds of shit. So like, I don't know that. I mean, I feel bad for her because I believe that she didn't sign up for this. I believe her that she didn't, she doesn't want this. And it's very evident in the way that she behaves toward him. Still at the same time, she's wearing a $51,000 jacket with a big honking diamond ring on her finger. And she's, you know, she's going to be fine. It might be hard, but she's going to be fine. It's not like she's, you know, a single mother trying to make it in
the TANF.
Well, and she, as I understand it, she absorbs a great deal of media during the day and
negative
reports
media too.
Yeah, exactly. And reports back to her husband on how he's being maligned here, there, and everywhere in the press, and that she's very much about him controlling his, you know, his media presence. And that's got to be a pretty frustrating place to live right now because there's no controlling this.
Yeah. I mean, and I just want to say, you know, and I don't want to project on her at all, but I'm a domestic abuse survivor. And every time I see her and every time I see her with him and in public or, you know, it is just, it's so triggering because you just, it's so, like, again, I don't know what their private life is like. I don't know their history, and it could just be my interpretation of it. But it just feels to me like I know that look. I know that action. I know that, like, you know, the looking down and just her body language with him, the slapping away of his hands. Like, it just, it is just, I've been there, and and I feel it. I feel it every time I see her. And I, you know, I don't feel necessarily bad for her. You know, she's in a position where she could, you know, have access to resources. But I do think that there is some seriously domestically abusive relationships or, you know, interactions going on in that situation.
I agree. Which is why she probably doesn't want to live here.
Yeah. I don't blame her. Yeah. No, I don't blame her at all. I think that Molly's exactly right. She is also complicit in all of this, but I agree that I'd like to, I don't know. I feel so many ways about her, but I agree that I think that there's probably, I mean, all of his other wives have accused him of domestic violence and rape, so I don't know why he'd be different with her.
There was somebody who made some comment, I don't even know if this is true, but I'd heard that whenever they met the Pope, that the Pope said to her in another language that he knew that she spoke, looking at Trump, saying, "Do you feed him? What is it? The nutrition?"
Oh, it's a pastry. I thought it was some kind of pastry.
Oh, I don't know. But like some kind of a very specific, like super fattening pastry. Like he basically, the Pope basically made a fat joke to the first lady. What are you feeding him?
That's fantastic.
Kind of was like, you know, completely downtrodden, and he said that, and she kind of looked at him and went, "What?" And he said it again, and she goes, "Oh, yeah." Like, looked at him and went, "Yeah."
Yeah. Well, we can end on that levity note, because, oh my God, that photo with the Pope, man, so many internet memes have come out of that.
Man.
No. My favorite of the week was Macron. Absolutely.
That was good.
I and you know that in his office before he went to this thing, he's like practicing with his aides, you know, how to not be pulled in. And, you know, he like ran through it like 20 times so that he had a really fabulous strategy ready to go. Cause that was a rock star move.
That was so good.
All right, that was
ladies,
so great.
On that note, we are out of time, but I want to thank all of you so very much for being here. It was just lovely talking to you. And next week we'll be back with Irreverent Testimony as normally scheduled. I am Rachel.
I am Molly.
I'm Sarah.
Oh, sorry. I thought we were doing announcements.
Yeah, go.
And I'm Arliss Bunny.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.